Thank you for the invitation. So I'll start with some disclaimers. This talk will be based on two papers which I wrote recently with my condensed matter colleague in Kentucky. And I'll start with some disclaimers that this talk is not about Prabhalipschitz gravity. In fact, it's not even about gravity. It's about an example of this phenomenon called emergent gauge fields, which is very popular in condensed matter physics, and to some particle theorists, a kind of a philosophical nice thing. And I'll be examining natures of emergent gauge fields in situations when the ultraviolet theory is not Lorentz invariant, namely of the Lipschitz type. The motivation, and clearly it's a motivation so far, we haven't found anything yet, is to find possible applications to condensed matter systems. However, there could be some lessons which we may have implications to low energy behavior of other Lipschitz theories, some generic features which maybe if I get some time, get to talk about. So let me start with some background. This is generally a gravity audience. We're all familiar with the O3 sigma model. It's a popular model for magnets, ferromagnets and antiferromagnets, where the sigma model field is something which is denoted by N, that's not the way, by N, which has a constraint that N square is equal to 1. Now, there is a well-known and interesting way of writing the sigma model field in the following form, in terms of some two-component complex vector, which is called a spin-on in the literature. And then this constraint, N square equal to 1, becomes the constraint that phi dagger phi is equal to 1. However, as is obvious, for example, for accounting of the number of fields, this is a redundant description. There are too many of these phis to be able to describe just three real fields, n. And the redundant description manifests itself in the fact that there is a gauge symmetry. If I take phi and multiply it by a phase, is generally a function of x, this definition doesn't change, this constraint doesn't change, so that's a symmetry, gauge symmetry of the problem. Gauge symmetries are not symmetries, they're redundancies of description, and this is something which you have just put in by hand in a description which was not redundant to begin with. This is what is called the CP1 model, not a big deal because CP1 is the same as O3. If you have an n-component complex vector phi with the same conditions, namely phi dagger phi is 1 and phi is identified with the phase transformation of phi, we have what we call a CPn-1 model because that defines the manifold CPn-1. If I take the original Lagrangian of the sigma model and write it in terms of these fields phi, this is what I get. A standard kinetic term for phi, and a square of a current, which is the standard current which couples, which would normally couple a complex scalar coupling to a gauge field. Pardon? It's not defined in terms of any sigma model field. It's just a generalization of CP1 to CPn-1. In fact, that's an interesting story. It's interesting that nobody does this. I mean, usually people take CP1 model, calculate things at large n, CPn-1, and say it must be something universal about O3 as well. This is, of course, the situation when n is related to phi in the O3. The model, of course, has gauge symmetry, but no gauge fields. So let's introduce a gauge field. There's a gauge field A mu with a covariant derivative which is standard. This thing can be written as that. If you integrate out the A mu, which appears quadratically in that action, you get back exactly that Lagrangian. So this is the standard story for O3. The same Lagrangian will be taken to define the CPn-1 model, which we will deal with in this talk. phi is now an n-component complex vector. It's useful to absorb an overall coupling constant, which is always sitting in front of the Lagrangian, by rescaling the fields and writing the constraint in this fashion. That's just a choice. You can work the other way as well. And introduce this constraint by introducing a Lagrange multiplier fields, which I call chi. So far, we have introduced some redundant degrees of freedom, a gauge field, which has no dynamics, and you might think, what's the use of all this? Well, in the 1980s, this model was popular among particle theorists. And the reason why it was popular among particle theorists is because it provided a very nice example of an asymptotically free model which dynamically generates mass, as we will show a little bit later. I'll just give you the results now. We can show very explicitly in the large n limit. All nonlinear sigma models in two dimensions with compact target space manifolds are asymptotically free, and so is this one, CPn minus 1. And as we will find, as a result, what happens is, so the coupling is flowing to large values in the infrared, and as is typical of such theories, it generates a mass gap. In fact, in this case, the mass gap enters as an expectation value of the Lagrange multiplier field. If you remember the way this happens, it will give a mass to the field phi if that acquires an expectation value. If you calculate the form of that mass gap, it has the form displayed here, which is typical of asymptotic freedom. Lambda is a cutoff, F is a bare coupling of the theory, and of course, for this to be physical, the beta function can be calculated, which is again a standard FQ beta function as in asymptotic freedom. And here comes the interesting part. The interesting part is that what it does is actually make that gauge field, which had no dynamics at the classical level, it makes it dynamical through a diagram, which is basically that. You can just explicitly calculate the diagram. The thing that is running in the loop is
So this thing, of course, you can calculate even for finite n. It's very difficult to show that a mass gap is generated for finite n. You can calculate the beta function, and then use the usual argument that if the beta function has no other infrared fixed point, a mass will be generated. Once a mass is generated, this calculation is better. And you get a gauge field kinetic energy, which is quite standard. It couldn't have been anything else, because this is the lowest dimension operator, which you can write in terms which is in this case Lorentz invariant, and which is gauge invariant. The coupling constant of the theory is provided by the mass scale, which is dynamically generated. So we have this interesting phenomenon that quantum effects induce these dynamics, as we will show. This is something which you can explicitly see in the Tuft large n expansion, where the coupling goes to zero and tends to infinity, and the Tuft coupling is very finite.
So what are the observables in this theory?
What are the observables in this theory in terms of the phi's gauge invariant observables?
Loss and loops.
Well, in two dimensions, as we'll say, something is a bit trivial. So that's the next slide. So in two dimensions, the gauge field is rather boring. There is nothing much to it. So there are no photons, of course. You can write gauge invariant observables. They don't do very much. And basically, it's just a sigma model where you have some nice thing of a dynamical generation of a gauge field kinetic term. Not very interesting. Things start become interesting in three dimensions. This is the dimension which is interesting for condensed matter physics. And this is the case which has been of great interest recently in the literature. And the reason is as follows. In three dimensions, a sigma model has a phase transition. So in terms of the original coupling, in the Tuft coupling lambda, there is a fixed point. There is an IR unstable fixed point. To the left of the fixed point, you have an ordered phase. The nature of the ordering, of course, depends on the microscopic model. for example, if it is an anti-ferromagnet, there will be a nil-ordered phase. If it's a ferromagnet, it's just going to be a regular ferromagnetic phase. And on the right side of this, for large values of the coupling, if you're on the right side of this phase transition point, you flow at long distances to strong coupling, and it's a phase which is disordered. This phase is gapless, which has spin wave excitations. That phase is gapped because it's completely disordered. And here, a similar large N calculation would give you the following expression for the expectation value of the Lagrange multiplier field. You can check that this Lagrange multiplier field is non-zero only in this phase. The beta function reflects this. If you can see the sign of the beta function flips as you cross that critical point. The reason why B equal to 3 is interesting for condensed matter systems is that in D equal to 3, a gauge field has a bit of a life. There is a single polarization mode of a photon, and so it's interesting to ask what happens to this polarization mode. However, as Polyakov had brilliantly shown, maybe 35 years ago, a compact U1 gauge field, the U1 gauge symmetry we had was a compact symmetry, it was just a phase e to the I theta. A compact gauge field always confines, and we will review a little bit in our context the mechanism. The reason why it confines is because there are instantons in this theory, which is pretty well controlled. We are always working with a fixed cutoff. If you don't like the cutoff, what you can do is to think of the U1 theory as embedded in an SU2 theory, which is broken down to U1 at some scale. So that scale acts as the cutoff. The monopoles, these are called monopoles. They're really instantons. They're called monopoles because as solutions, they just are. It's a Polyakov monopoles. And they disorder the vacuum, leading to a mass gap. It leads to a mass gap, and the charges are confined. Yeah.
How do you define the quantum theory?
What do you mean?
When you introduce the gauge field, you do it in the standard path and rolling way, I guess, except that it's at infinite coupling, infinite gauge coupling. There's no kinetic.
Right. So, but there's an integral over A mu, so that's...
You don't worry about that? Or?
Oh, it's just A mu is like a field which only appears quadratically without any derivatives. You do the functional integral, do a Gaussian integral, get back to the sigma model. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. So there are two things that happen. The theory develops a mass gap. All excitations, all gauge invariant excitations are massive. And secondly, the charges in the theory, in which case the spinons, are confined. Now, you might think that in three dimensions, this is not much of a big deal, because after all, the Coulomb law is also not something which decays at large distances. But the Coulomb law in two space and one time dimension is logarithmic, and the big deal about what Polyakov showed is that this logarithmic potential actually becomes a confining linear potential, and that's non-trivial. So what this means, that normally there is no excitation corresponds to a massless photon in the original spin model. If you trust this large N calculations and take, so the large N calculation used to get to the gauge field, and then you look at the gauge dynamics, there is no photon because it's gone. There are, however, some situations in model condensed matter systems. I don't know whether they actually are there in nature. People certainly hope that these are in nature, where for reasons related to the microscopic nature of the model, monopoles are suppressed, or effectively the gauge field U1 becomes non-compact. Now, a non-compact U1 gauge theory in three dimensions does not confine. So therefore, if you can have such a situation, then you should be able to see an absence of a mass gap and a real photon. So that, one of these situations is actually quite famous. It's something which is called deconfined criticality. You can look at many articles written on this field.
So then what you have now really shown, if you trust this large N calculations for the original sigma model, or if you just take that sigma model with a gauge field which doesn't have a kinetic term, you didn't have a photon to begin with, a photon has emerged out of the dynamics. In fact, if you trust that something like this can be done for an ON model, for example, but nobody knows how to do it, you would say that the ON model had this hidden gauge field in it. It was, well, of course, gauge symmetry is always a redundancy. There was nothing there to begin with. You would have been able to look at this if you worked infinitely hard in terms of the original variables. Everything should be able to do in terms of the original variables, but it is extremely difficult. It's completely non-transparent, but in this way, you have a dramatic emergence of the U1 gate field. In this talk, what I'll describe is another situation where a gapless photon remains. And this would be in the multicritical point of a CPN-1 model, which is tuned at the Lipschitz point.
Will you say in a second what suppresses the instantons in the...
So that depends on some of the microscopics. In one of the situations, what happens is that one deals with the model of antiferromagnets, and because of the antiferromagnetic nature of the coupling, what happens is that you can think of these monopoles as producing some flux through a clockex of the lattice. The fluxes have different phases on different adjoining clockets. And as a result, what these people argue is that monopoles of a minimal charge cannot exist because of the lattice structure. Only monopoles of charge 4, modulo 4 can exist. And monopoles of such high charge are thought to be irrelevant operators. I mean, a lot of this is...
Okay, so the key point is that Polyakov was looking at a continuum theory, and it's the discrete structure of the lattice that could suppress the instantons.
He was looking, of course, you're looking at length scales always bigger than the lattice spacing. But sometimes what happens, even though the discrete structure of the lattice, most of it is washed out in the long distance limit, some topological features can remain. And either some of these topological features give rise to this phenomenon that only monopoles of charge 4, 8, 16 can exist. You cannot...
So the answer is yes to my question. The difference is... Polyakov treated it as a continuum, and there's some residual effect of the discrete structure.
Right, and for Polyakov, it was important that the minimal charge monopoles, like on Dirac quantization, are relevant in the theory. So this is one of the situations. I think there are other situations where people think of adding a huge chemical potential to the monopoles, in which case there will be an entire phase where there will be a photon rather. Yes?
Yeah, I want to ask a question, and I'm not sure whether this is a question or comment, but I want your feedback about, quote, whether we trust the technique that led to those conclusions. All you did is introduce an auxiliary field to simplify the classical theory,
uh-huh.
and quantize, that is, find the pattern of the auxiliary field.
Yes.
So my question is, when you introduce an auxiliary field, you make the Lagrangian as simple as possible, that is, you made it cubic so that the field equations are quadratic. And two points. One of them is it's always possible to do that, to introduce more auxiliary fields.
Absolutely. Right.
And simplify the classical plane of motion. And then my sort of query is, shouldn't we always do that in the quantization, because there will be less quantum ambiguities if we have lower order field, quantum field equations?
I guess so. You might ask whether this entire procedure, you might ask the relevance of this in terms of the original spin model, which didn't have any gauge fields.
Well, but classically it's the same. Classically you start with the same model.
That's correct.
Just what become the gauge fields are auxiliary fields, and therefore let me put it this way: if we saw it from a canonical quantization point of view,
mm-hmm.
the version with the auxiliary fields has less divergences to try to remove in the operator dynamics.
I haven't thought along those lines, but that
because there's only going to be products of two operators, whereas in the original theory, there's products of 3, 4, 5, 6, et cetera, operators that you have to define the dynamics. So shouldn't the question be the other way around? That is, shouldn't we presume that the theory with as many auxiliary fields as possible at the red path integral?
You could take that attitude. Of course, what these guys are interested in is actually describing a real sigma model, which describes a real magnet. So, I mean, the simplest, you might say that, okay, the simplest thing to write down is not the sigma model, but the CP model, the Pn minus model.
I just want to add to it that in some sense, you can introduce as many auxiliary fields as you find practical, but in the end, it's a dynamical question.
Of course, it's a dynamical question.
Once you start becoming updating and making this, the correct degrees of freedom in the Mani Lagrangian, the auxiliary fields are a way of introducing the correct degrees of freedom to
calculating at all. Well, I don't know what's correct or incorrect. I mean, if you work very, very hard, you should certainly be able to do it in terms of the original variables. You have to work very hard to define the measure properly. You have to very hard, I mean, as you're saying, to define the operator products properly, and presumably you would be able to get the same result. But that you can say for any gauge theory. You can say that I'll write any gauge theory in terms of which are loop variables. I mean, in a sense, sometimes try to do that. But then, of course, it becomes extremely hard. It's easier to have these redundant degrees of freedom too.
Well, it's more practical if you have a guess. Sure.
Sometimes you have a guess, like ADS-CFT is a fantastic guess. I mean, there's a n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory, and you want to write it in terms of gauge invariant variables, and you guessed it probably quite correctly. It's a type 2 B-string theory living on ADS. So that's a fantastic example of this thing. Yeah. But to begin with, I mean, that might be hard. Yes, please.
Oh, just to continue this discussion, at the base level, I'd be exactly equivalent to do that. But as you go through the renormalization group and you include the irrelevant operators, you might end up with a completely different theory in one case and the other.
Right.
So I think the point is well taken. I mean, this may be the right. But the only comment I have to make is that it probably the comment also applies to the usual gauge theories.
By the way, the motivation for my comment is the Plobansky form in general. So when we go to four dimensions, the fact that there's a form of the field equation which is quadratic when you put in the
I see.
Field
okay.
Is much better than infinite order.
Okay.
In
yes.
Terms of the original variable.
Okay. So let me define the model I'll be talking about. So I'll just generalize the CPN minus one model
and include operators which are naively irrelevant. In fact, what I'll do is, so there is the standard kinetic term. I'll be working in Euclidean space, but still make a distinction between time and space because eventually you'd like to analytically continue the results to Lorentzian signature. So this is standard time derivative kinetic term. And this is the standard space derivative term. If alpha was 1, this could be, or could rescale it to 1, this would form a Lorentz invariant or Euclidean invariant combination. But I have added to it a term which has higher derivatives. This is a symbol for something which is very complicated, which contains some z derivatives. For example, and the case, this is the case where we will be interested in, for z equal to 2, this thing can have two possible terms with the two ways of putting in the covariant derivatives in front of the part. I'll call the two coupling constants A and B, and I'll be interested in fine-tuning. I'll be interested in going to fine-tuned multicritical points which might have some interesting infrared behavior. So I'll be exclusively working at the Lifshitz point, where alpha has been set to 0, so there's one fine tuning already, where, as we all know, the scaling of time and, this should be x going to lambda times x, not x going to lambda times t. The scaling of x and t are different. The scaling dimensions of the field phi and the coupling constant f are written entirely in terms of the length dimension l as follows. So you notice that when d is equal to z, this is dimensionless. The coupling is dimensionless, and things start appearing to be similar to what had happened in two-dimensional standard sigma models. It's not very hard to show that the coupling, so we already showed that the coupling is marginal when d is equal to z. It's not very hard to show that the coupling is, in fact, asymptotically free for any d equal to z. But we will be interested, in fact, for D equal to Z equal to 2, that's a three-dimensional theory with Z equal to 2 Lipschitz scaling. So in that case, this is the form of that Lagrangian. And the way to, and this is the standard way to solve such a large N vector model in the Hoopf limit, you integrate out the field, phi, so you get a trace log, which is like that. And that term just comes from here. And then you note that the nature of the Hoopf limit tells you that both these terms are of order n. This is order n because f square n is lambda, that's held fixed. So you write it as n upon lambda. That's order n because there is a trace over the n degrees of freedom. So there is an n which comes entirely outside of the effective Lagrangian. So once that happens, then the leading solution, large n solution, is obtained by a saddle point of the path integral over chi and a. And this is the Hartree-Fock saddle point equation for this theory. For some reason, I put in the alpha. Forget, set alpha to 0. You can solve this equation, and that is the solution. When a is a numerical constant, it's, as far as I remember, something 4 pi. This is would be the mass generated by the spin-on fields. And the fact that you are working with non-trivial scaling appears as the way this is related to the lambda, which is the inverse of the length cutoff. We're always be using a length cutoff in the theory.
On a real minimum, not some maximum.
Well, that's how the way...
just a stationary solution, so...
Right. So the way one usually does this is to take this solution and just find out... It's a, like a local minimum. It's not a maximum, because you can calculate the quadratic, you know, fluctuations around this minimum, and they are all are positive coefficients. I don't know how to tell whether it's a global minimum or not, but I'll just trust them.
So your propagator is always positive definite. That's what you're saying.
That's right.
And that doesn't depend on the gate field.
That doesn't depend on the gate field. So this immediately shows that the coupling F is now asymptotically free. For even though it's three dimensions, there is no more phase transition at some finite value of the coupling, and the RG flow of the coupling looks like this. So you expand around the saddle point, and then you go ahead and calculate the effective action for the chi's and the a's. So I'll now give you the results for the calculation of the gauge field action, which is the interesting part for us. So we have to calculate a determinant or a trace log, which looks like this. So we're going to do this calculation by some standard techniques using this DeWitt-Schwinger representation. I'll not give you the details of all that, but just tell you what the result is. The way this calculation is done is...
So it leaves us back one slide. How has a gauge field arisen in this case?
Oh, you started out with a gauge field. There were covariant derivatives already.
Okay. From the very beginning.
Yeah. But there were no dynamics, so we're going to discover the dynamics. Okay. So you do this calculation. There are well-known techniques of, you know, performing these integrals over SS and performing these tricks. We want to have a flash look at that. This is a standard heat kernel calculation. And then we expand in powers of the field strengths. And this is the result which you get. And I'll now comment on this result. These A and B, recall, are the two parameters, two coupling constants. These are the two ways in which the derivatives appear in front of phi. Just to remind you. So that was A and B.
Since you're reminding me right here, so if those were ordinary derivatives, I could have integrated by parts and turned one term into the other term.
That's correct. Right.
So why don't we do that and just, I mean, reorganize it in terms of expressions involving the field strength?
Yes.
Which seems to be what your calculation does anyway.
Yeah, that's what it does. Yeah.
But it seems like you might have more parameters. I don't see why those won't be.
So this is the rewriting of that in terms of d squared and some derivatives.
Right, but
You've written two terms. Are you sure those are the only, you have two parameters. Are you sure there aren't more parameters if I'm willing to write f's and f's?
I mean, if you just have z equal to 2, so we have total of two derivatives acting on the phi, these are the only two ways you could do it. Di dj, di dj, or d squared.
I think what Rob is asking is, these two terms are equivalent up to a term which is only dependent on the gauge field.
And its derivatives.
Sure.
Yeah. So that is this way of writing it.
Right.
Sorry. I think he has three operators, two of which are independent. That's it.
Yeah.
There is Fij, Dφ, Dφ bar, and this, the two operators. But there is a integrated by parts, only two are independent. He has chosen that.
I've just chosen those
the other two, but two are independent.
But I wouldn't include an f squared term, or I mean, I just, well, maybe we can talk about it later.
No, we are not including anything which has just gives dynamics of the f by itself. I mean,
no,
we just take
f squared phi. Let's talk about it later.
Okay, that's all about that. Okay, and this is the, yes.
So you're at the Lipschitz point.
At exactly the Lipschitz point, right?
So when you define the when you calculate the trace log, you have to regulate or normalize. So
absolutely.
You have to be careful to refine tune to L equals 0.
Right. Absolutely. You have to, yes. So one thing I should say that, yeah, you have to retune that from 1 upon n effect to take alpha to 0. So leading n, that retuning doesn't happen, but you certainly have to regularize and renormalize. In fact, if you go to the next slide, these are the lowest terms. So the first two terms is what is what you would call g equal to 2 electrodynamics. And this thing here is a renormalization state. I mean, you can just do a dimension counting and find that b square has the term in front of b square should be dimensionless. The term in terms of the electric field has dimensions of 1 upon this m, which is the dynamically generated mass. And that's the way it appears.
Right. So that's what you should do if you did the 1 upon n corrections to this thing. And that's exactly what you should do. You did the renormalized alpha to 0. Yeah.
Is there any reason why this theory should satisfy detailed balance? It seems to this action. There might be, or is it just the most general form of the action? Are there any other terms that could have been generated by dimension counting, dimensional analysis, and then now?
Yeah, there could be other terms which could be generated. This is a result of an explicit calculation. In fact, I'll show something interesting about this. Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know if this has come up with these time calculations. If you go back to one slide, to the operator that you, to that operator that you took the trace determinant of, at least at linear order neglecting the gauge fields, that doesn't break Lorentz invariance, that deforms Lorentz invariance. That is, that has an energy dependent or momentum dependent Lorentz invariance. And so a query would be, does that control the calculation and determine which terms appear and which terms don't appear? That is.
You mean if I just kept this, maybe I didn't understand it.
So just in that operator. So p0 squared plus p to the fourth plus m squared. Okay.
Oh, if there was no gauge field.
Yeah. Then that has, then that doesn't break Lorentz invariance, that's in a class of deformations of Lorentz invariance. Maybe there's a question for discussion later.
Yeah, I have to learn. I don't understand, maybe you could explain this to me. Yeah.
You also have an infrared regulator. It seems that you have sort of Landau levels at some point.
Right, so there's it's in a box. Yeah. Right, you know, that's how we do the calculation.
The
so the effective action.
If E is strong enough, the vacuum will be unstable, don't you think so?
Why would the vacuum be unstable?
Because, I mean, this negative term there can have.
No, this is an I.
Yeah, but this derivative, I'm worried about that, where you've got a very low eigenvalues.
We certainly did the calculation up to four powers of B, and there was no negative term.
Okay.
a very deep reason for that. It's because of the eye. And that's what the, and here comes a surprise. And the surprise is that you would expect that doing this calculation, you would always generate b squared, b4, b6, which you indeed do for generic values of a and b. However, there's something very interesting which happens when a, one of those parameters, is tuned to zero. You can see that the b squared term vanishes, and we at first we just kept doing the calculations to higher and higher powers of b, and found that there are no terms which have just pure powers of b. Everything had derivatives in b. And then we found there's a good reason why that happens. And this is in fact the
in fact, if we find out for constant b, what is the effective action? So this is the infrared regulator. This is the effective action divided by the volume. Goes as exponential of 1 upon b. And there's a very good reason why that happens. So let's do, in fact, the calculation for constant b and the electric field equals 0. Right. So then, as you can see that this operator is the square of the Landau operator. So you can trivially do this. You write down the eigenvalues of this. You can do the sum. So those are the eigenvalues. That's the degeneracy. And you don't want to look at this, but just to see that you can, the sum can be written in terms of some interesting theta functions. You can do the integrals. You write them in terms of modified Bessel functions. You know how to take the asymptotic limit. And what you find, they're all exponentials of 1 upon b. Okay. So there are no terms which vanish as powers of b. So they, at this multicritical point, naively, you would imagine that the effective action is going to be just purely z equal to 2 electrodynamics. I'll give some provisos to this. The reason why I haven't taken into account those non-analytic terms in B is that in some naive RG sense, they're sort of infinitely irrelevant. I mean, they go faster to zero than any power of B, but this, of course, could be dangerous. I mean, I'm open to the possibility that there could be something interesting which comes from that. So from now on, what I'll do, I'll analyze the z equal to 2 electrodynamics in detail and ask the question, is the theory confining, does the theory acquire a mass gap? So it's useful to write this in terms of gauge invariant field strengths. This is just a useful way of doing it. So you just define it as the Hodge dual of F mu mu, and you take this action, choose your favorite gauge, calculate the perturbative correlators of the gauge fields. Okay. And as you would have expected, the perturbative correlator has poles at omega squared plus k4 equal to 0, which is typical of a Lipschitz behavior. We want to see whether non-perturbatively in the infrared, these poles remain or what happens. So as Polyakov pointed out, for standard electrodynamics, the main difference is the presence of this instanton monopoles. So what are these monopoles? These are solutions of the Euclidean equations of motion. These are the equations of motion, but violations of the Bianchi identity. So this is the Gauss law, which is obtained by changing A naught, which can be solved in three dimensions in terms of a scalar field. That's what I have done. And this is Faraday's law, or whatever law that is. And this can be used to write the zeroth component of that gauge invariant field strength in some non-local fashion in terms of that scalar field. The Bianchi identity would have been the divergence of H equal to zero. So now the divergence of H is some object which I'll call the monopole density. And once you put that in, this equation becomes that equation, which since H naught is also related to this, so this is a linear equation which you can solve in terms of chi, some horrible in position space, but quite easy in momentum space.
Fine, I missed that.
Oh, sorry. So H is just the dual of H.
Oh, so please say more about the Bianchi identity not holding, even though it's an identity.
So these are monopoles, after all. So they violate Bianchi identities. I mean, they violate, I mean, normally it's a divergence of B is not equal to zero. So they violate, of course, it's a singular configuration, of course. But we are always working on a lattice. If you want to do a better job, you think of the continuum SU2 theory, for example. That's one of the things which Polyakov did. Break it down to U1, and there are really two Polyakov monopoles, where, of course, all the equations of motion of the non-abelian gauge fields are nicely satisfied. But in terms of the effective long distance U1, this is what's going to happen. This singularity, we have to impose a Dirac quantization condition so that the singularity is invisible to the elementary charges of the theory. So the solution to this, you write in terms of a Green's function, G0, and this is the Fourier transform of that Green's function. As expected, that Green's function has a pole at omega squared plus k4 equals 0. And this is the action for some given monopole, or I keep telling them monopoles, but everybody calls them monopoles. They're really instant terms. There's some instant term densities rho. For
a monopole which is sitting at some point with some charge q, the way we have put in the pi's and couplings in the theory tells you that q has to be 2 pi times an integer divided by g. So here comes the important point. If you calculate the action for a single monopole, it's of course going to be ultraviolet divergent because the self-energy diverges. But the crucial thing is that this doesn't have an infrared divergence. And the meaning of that is as follows. If it did have an infrared divergence, what would this mean is that if I take the volume of the system to be large, it will be more and more costly to have monopoles. On the other hand, the entropy factor for a monopole always scales as something raised to the volume. So if there was an infrared divergence which was proportional to the volume, then there could be a situation where by tuning couplings, you could have monopoles irrelevant or monopoles relevant. This is what happens for the costless solid phase transition. In this case, this doesn't happen because this thing doesn't, to a lowest order, doesn't depend on the volume. The entropy depends on the volume, so the monopoles are always relevant in the theory. Relevant in the sense they always proliferate the vacuum. This was Polyakov's main argument. And of course, for Polyakov, there was no k square, and the thing was omega square plus k square, and the same argument still holds. It is well known that a Coulomb gas has a dual representation in terms of a Sine-Gordon theory. And that's what happens for the standard monopole gas in 2 plus 1 dimensional electrodynamics. So I'm going to show you how this happens in our case. We don't have a Coulomb gas. We have this modified gas whose propagator is not 1 upon omega squared plus k squared plus, but this k squared divided by omega squared k4. But nevertheless, if you look at that action, S rho was the action for a given monopole charge density rho. This is an identity where this action is like that. So it's some novel non-relativistic version of Sine-Gordon theory, which is just a representation of the monopole part of the action of electrodynamics. You might think that there are actually two scalar fields, two degrees of freedom, which you have come up with. I've written is phi1 and phi2. But you must remember, just structure of the action tells you that phi2 is canonically conjugate to phi1, or the other way around. We'll choose one of those polarizations. So there is actually really one scalar field. The next steps are also quite standard. So you assume that, and self-consistently assume, that the dominant contribution to the path integral is given by a dilute gas of these instantons. And you do the sum over all instantons. The object zeta is the fugacity of a monopole. The fugacity depends on the action of a single monopole, which you can check is 1 upon g squared times a, where a is a lattice spacing or the inverse. Whenever I introduce a regulator, it has dimensions of length or inverse length, not of time. Okay. And there are some powers of G4, G, which in this case happens to be G to the power 4. Those powers have to be there by dimensions. If you do the instanton calculation as standard, these powers come from the zero mode integrals around these instantons. So this part is an integral over the zero modes, which correspond to the location of the of these instantons. These are over instantons, these are over anti-instantons, and this is their mutual potential. G is that I've written in terms of discrete indices I and J. It's precisely that Green function which we have been talking about. It's an easy exercise to check that this sum can be now written as a functional integral over phi 1 and phi 2 in terms of this non-relativistic Sine-Gordon theory, which is displayed here. There is a mass scale in the theory, which is generated, which is what do you mean say generated, in the sense that this mass scale is just by definition proportional to the fugacity. The fugacity is exponential of minus 1 upon g square a, and that's important. There was a dimensional coupling in the theory, which was g square. So you would have thought that, you know, that's what controls the infrared physics, and of course Polyakov's great contribution was to show it's not that coupling which gives the infrared physics. What gives the infrared physics is this scale, which depends, which is exponentially more small compared to that, you know, that g square, the dimensionless coupling because of this factor. And this is the scale that's going to be important. Now, you look at this theory, so there are these two fields. Choose, say, phi 1 as your field, and phi 2 is the canonical conjugate. And you might think that, you know, this is clearly a mass term for phi 1, so the theory must be massive. There cannot be any gapless excitation. That, of course, is false. By continuation to Lorentzian signature, you can write down the Hamiltonian density. And what you find is almost standard, except that there is a derivative of the canonically conjugate momentum. There was an original symmetry in the theory of a shift of B going to B plus a constant. That became a symmetry of pi going to pi plus a constant. In a sense, this kind of duality exchanges momenta and coordinates, and that's what this has done. In a sense, this is a dual representation. It's for perturbative excitations, you can replace the cosine by 1 minus phi squared by 2, and these are a bunch of harmonic oscillators with p squared with k squared sitting in front of p squared. You can calculate the spectrum, and this is what the spectrum is. The spectrum is not gapped. It is gapless because k equal to 0 leads to e equal to 0, but this scale enters crucially. In fact, for momenta much, much smaller than m, it is, in fact, looks like a relativistic spectrum. But as we will argue, it doesn't quite become relativistic. Note, we are already working at the Lipschitz point. So we are not, you know, exciting the relevant directions which correspond to the standard kinetic terms. If you included those, I would expect that it will just flow to some Lorentz invariant theory. We are already at the Lipschitz point, and then doing it there, and then we are finding that, you know, at least the dispersion relation looks almost Lorentz invariant. I'll tell you why the answer is really not true. So this is a picture of the two dispersion relations. This is a perturbative dispersion relation, which we obtained from just the gauge fields, and this is what we get after you have included the action of the monopoles. Having done this, the physical question to ask is that what is the total complete propagator for the gauge invariant field strengths? We already computed those in perturbation theory and found that there's a poles at omega squared plus k4 equal to 0. So we want to include the effect of the instantons. In this case, this calculation is actually very easy. And the reason is that you write the field as the field due to monopoles plus the perturbative excitation. But the theory is a linear theory. Because it's a linear theory, this part of the correlator is exactly the same what was that there in the perturbation theory. See, normally when you do around instantons, you have to take into account the background, and it becomes a little bit complicated. That's what you would do in a non-abelian gauge theory. But since we are looking at scales much, much distances, much, much larger than the cutoff which you wish you could provide by some mass of a W boson if this was an AC2 theory. This certainly holds. This is something which we have already calculated. That's at that standard Lipschitz ball. So we got to calculate this. That calculation is actually also not very difficult, because these monopole fields are determined in terms of the monopole charge densities. So if I'm able to calculate the correlators of the monopole charge densities, I know what's the correlators of the gauge fields. And if you look at how the monopole charge densities enter, it just follows. This was the formula for the exponential of the action of the due to a monopole distribution, and this is the generating functional for determining the correlators of rho. As you can see from these two expressions, if I calculate this, all it does in that representation is to shift the field phi, because it's just I j rho, which just shifts by, you know, I 2 pi j by rho. So all you have is again a Sine-Gordon theory with a shifted value of the field phi. So now you can just do and just write down that action. I'll not show you what, and then look at small fluctuations around phi 1 equal to 0, and you can calculate this object, take derivatives, and obtain this answer for the two-point function of the monopole charge density. Given that, you plug things in, and you obtain the monopole contributions to the gauge fields, and that's what the answers are. You note that the monopole contributions, pretty much like the perturbative contributions, has a pole at omega squared plus k fourth equal to 0. It also has this new pole, which corresponds to the spectrum of the Sine-Gordon theory, which I had just displayed. And here is the magic. You sum them up, and you find that pole omega squared plus k fourth has vanished. It's no longer there. It just got replaced by this. In Polyakov's calculation, which is exactly similar, the two-point function just looks like that. So this is the case for z equal to 1, in which case there is no gapless pole. It's just as k squared plus m squared equal to 0. So that's the demonstration that in the gauge invariant correlators, there is no mass gap. In our case, we do still have a gap, but that's we do not have a gap. I mean, there's a gapless pole, but it's different from the perturbative pole, which has been completely canceled out by the monopole background. Now, even though the dispersion relation looks relativistic, namely like this, with the speed of light, which is provided by the dynamically generated mass scale in the theory, it's not really relativistic, but though I may be a bit wrong about this, the one thing I'd like you to note is that you can make a sort of non-local in position space redefinition of the fields, which sort of looks like this. This is the momentum space fields, H tilde as related by some factors here. And then when you rewrite the answers of those, this sort of looks like, you know, having some invariance under rotations. But these are, of course, in position space, highly non-local redefinitions. I haven't thought very hard about this.
Theories of the form Lorentz invariant. Ah, I see. That's what it is.
Okay, so we have
to talk about
that. Okay.
There's a lot understood about such dispersion. Okay. Good. So we found the theory still has a gapless spectrum, though different from the perturbative spectrum. We have to ask now the next question: what happens to the spin-ons, or what happens to elementary charges in the theory? And the answer to that would be to calculate, say, a Wilson loop in the time direction. So this is the standard expression for the Wilson loop. And as we know, Polyakov showed that for z equal to 1, this Wilson loop has an area law which gives a confining potential between charges. The Wilson loop is going to factorize into two parts, because I can write this. This is an Abelian theory. So I can write this in terms of a surface integral of the field strength. You can write it like that. And the Wilson loop is a product of the monopole contribution times quantum fluctuations. So we're going to do both these calculations. The calculation for the quantum fluctuations is, again, you know, something quite standard. We're not going to talk very much about it. The main meat of the story is, in fact, the monopole contribution. And once again, the monopole contribution can be calculated by already the formulas which I have displayed.
That's because this integral can be written again in terms of the monopole charge densities, right? And so it is e to the I times that. And if you go back a few slides, that is pretty much like that, where rho is, I'll give you expression, is replaced by some quantity which I will call eta of c. I'll give you an expression for this pretty soon, which depends on the loop. So at the end of the day, what this means is that the Wilson loop, the classical or the monopole contribution to the Wilson loop, is exactly that generating functional with the current j replaced by e times eta c. And this is the for a loop which is in the x2 equal to 0 plane. This is the time direction, that's the space direction. This is the expression for eta c. Okay? This expression might look a little bit weird. Let me explain the terms in the expression. This is that Green's function, which for g equal to 1 would be the Coulomb law. In our case, it's that modification. This is a delta function, which restricts to the plane of the loop. And this is a theta function, which is 0 only if the points x1 prime, t1 prime are inside the loop and non-zero outside. In fact, this is the potential due to a dipole layer which is formed by the loop. That's because, for example, in standard electrodynamics, this would be just the Coulomb potential, right? The dipole potential is a derivative of the Coulomb potential. And in fact, you can easily recognize that for g equal to 1 is just a solid angle which is subtended by that loop, that point. Okay? In this case, we have something different because that Green's function is different. Okay? The important thing about the fact that it is still a dipole layer will become quite obvious. It will tell you that, of course, a dipole layer would have the corresponding operator acting on this eta c will be this delta functions which will give you this layer. And you can easily check by rescaling fields and distances that there is a dimensionless coupling of this effective Sine-Gordon theory, which just turns out to be M upon G. You can check that this is actually dimensionless. If you calculate that, it's just 1 upon G square A square. So when the bare coupling constant is small, the integral over phi 1 and phi 2, which is involved in calculation of the Wilson loop, can be replaced by a saddle point. So that means I got to solve this, the equation of motion, which comes from this, with phi 1 replaced by this shift, plug it back into the action to obtain the Wilson loop. So you got to solve that equation. This is the contribution from this thing eta, which was the potential due to this dipole layer. It has the right form. It is a derivative of the delta function restricting to the loop. And it has the theta function, which restricts to the thing inside the loop. Okay. Now, the source term, for the source term tells you that in the x2 direction, phi must have a discontinuity as you cross that loop. And that's what happens for a dipole. If you take the potential due to a dipole, it has a discontinuity as you cross the surface, which is spanned, you know, by this loop. And so you're going to solve this equation with that discontinuity, whose coefficient is given by this 2 pi e upon g in mind. We're interested in Wilson loops where the time extent of the loop is very large. And we are also interested in long distance physics, where the spatial separation between these two currents, if you wish, is also very large. In that case, for most values in between, apart from these boundary effects, you can say that this object phi 1 is independent of the time, and it is independent of the space direction along which the loop lies. Because it's independent of time, this thing is 0, but the denominator is not 0 because it's still a function of x2, and nabla square is dx1 square plus dx2 square. So with this approximation, you can ignore this thing, and you have to just solve an ordinary differential equation in x2 with that specified discontinuity, and that's the solution. This is a well-known solution of the Sine-Gordon equation. For a minimal charge, the solution looks like this. So this is that discontinuity of that layer. And clearly, if you put this thing back in, what you're going to get, things were only a function of x2, which was the direction perpendicular to the loop. X1 was the direction along that loop. You're going to get an action of this configure of the saddle point, which is proportional to the area of the loop. So the Wilson loop will be, the monopole contribution to the Wilson loop is going to be proportional to the area, which is T times L. The string tension, which appears in there, is once again G squared times that mass, which has been generated, which you recall is exponential of minus 1 upon G squared. That's typically of dynamically generated masses. It turns out that when the charges are not odd integers, but even integers, the situation is a little more complicated. These people have looked at this in the literature for the standard Z equal to 1 case, and much of the discussion actually goes through for us. But the answer still turns out to be an area law. I must just say that we also did a long and quite painful calculation to check this result by looking at the linearized approximation by taking the cosine to be 1 minus phi squared and directly calculating that loop and doing a Fourier transform. We got the same results. So let me summarize the results we got, not that we understand everything about it. So by considering a special multicritical points of the CPN minus 1 sigma models, we were related to Z equal to 2 electrodynamics in D equal to 3. Monopole instantons were shown to proliferate the vacuum for any value of the gauge coupling. They generate a mass scale which is exponentially small compared to the mass scale set by the coupling constant. However, unlike the standard Z equal to 1 theory, they are not able to disorder the vacuum completely. There is still a gapless excitation present in the spectrum. Nevertheless, the spin-ons are still confined. There would be neutral objects in the theory which would feel this long-range potential. If you calculate bulk quantities like the specific heat of the theory, that would reflect the fact that it has a gapless spectrum, but the charges would still have a linear potential between them. So we call this thing confined criticality because there was no confinement, but still critical. Provisos. In the context of the original spin models, there were terms which are non-analytic in B. I completely ignored that in my discussion of the Z equal to 2 electrodynamics. As I said, they appear naively to be irrelevant, but who knows? One has to really do a calculation, and we're trying to get a handle on such a calculation. It certainly breaks that shift symmetry which was responsible for this gapless mode. So we don't know what the result of that would be. Our result for the electrodynamics should be taken as a result for Z equal to 2 electrodynamics. And it's obviously important to investigate if these terms lead to a mass gap. The more urgent task, which we are making slight amount of progress, is to actually find microscopic models, microscopic spin models, not so far as models which do with experiments, but at least some models where you can have an idea of how to get to these multicritical points. This model which we write was guessed at by general symmetry grounds, you know. Like if you have Z equal to 2 scaling, you know, this will be the lowest terms you can write down. But of course, in a microscopic model, you have to identify what microscopic parameters you need to tune to get to such multicritical points. We don't have much of an idea about how to do that. And of course, the second thing is a dream, which I wouldn't talk very much about. At a more modest theoretical level, it may be important to generalize our work to situations which appear in these models of deconfined criticality, where you have peculiar phases which sort of remove monopoles of the minimal charge. That's something we haven't thought very much about, but we want to. And again, at a theoretical, as a level of a theoretical exercise, it would be interesting to see, and I don't see why not, how non-abelian gauge fields can be generated in this particular fashion. In particular, you might think of D equal to 3 and Z equal to 3. That would be the situation for 3 plus 1 dimensional. And it would be interesting just to see whether a non-abelian gauge dynamics actually induced in the theory. Thank you.
I see the results, but I'm still, is there some straightforward intuition as to why monopoles disorder the vacuum in the one case and don't in the other? What's making that happen?
I don't know of really a physical way of answering your question, but it is slightly more physical and less technical level. It's the departure from Coulomb's law, what is doing it. Normally, so what I think, in a sense, there is a picture of the confinement in this case, where I shouldn't say about. Yeah, it's a departure of the fact that you don't have a Coulomb law. What it is happening is that if you look at the Green's function and see what is its behavior in position space, it has a tail which is sort of like that. Because it's pretty much like a Schrodinger problem, you know? And so I think what it does is at a given time, you know, it sort of the effect of these things decay at long distances. Whereas for normal monopoles, it's like a power law. So, you know, a monopole here feels the presence of a monopole very far away very easily.
So it's just the different scaling forces, this weaker strength.
I think so. But I don't really have a good answer. I would love to have a physical picture. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, have you thought about this model at finite temperature?
I've certainly thought about this model at finite temperature. I haven't done very much about it. One of the things we would really like to know is actually precisely this behavior of the specific heat. Mm-hmm. You know, how would that be reflected in there? But you have something else in mind?
No, I'm just curious, yeah. And also in the case of the different scalars, there's some very interesting behavior when you turn off finite temperature.
Yeah, so that's another thing, this ultra, what is this called, ultra-local behavior, right? Yeah, that's another motivation we have to look at this, because there are these examples where the correlation functions are ultra-local. So whether that follows in this theory, I have no idea. I think this ultra-locality is some very strong version of this kind of correlation.
My second question is, if you go away from z equal to 2 and end up in the modulated phase, do you expect that phase to be gapped, or do you know what the expectations will be on that side of it?
I believe that anywhere you go out of multi-criticality, the phase will be gapped. I mean, generally, it will be gapped. But there would be a modulated phase.
A naive question about the relation, possible relation to Lipschitz gravity. So you showed us an example where you write a theory that has some two-component or n-component spinner field, complex field, and a gauge field emerges as one of the effective degrees of freedom. So it wasn't evident in the original Lagrangian.
It's not obvious.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So should we draw any lesson from this about what could happen in Lipschitz gravity? That is, if we know the form of Lagrangian in the UV, because Petter told us, could it be that the low energy effective theory has not just a metric, which I saw in the original Lagrangian, but also, let's say, a vector field? And we saw it in the conference, an example where I'm rewriting it. So there's a scalar. But what I want to know is, what about a full-blown a vector that's not the gradient of a scalar, that's not hypersurface orthogonal?
It could be. I think it's. One of the lessons of this thing is actually this formula. This might actually teach us something. That this this expression for this action for the, or even just the sign border thing, but this. So you can see what's happening. This is just a read. You can easily integrate our height in this action, right? And then you get something quite complicated, which is an expansion whose lowest term of the expansion would be like a Lifshitz theory in terms of the phi 1. Okay? Because it's like when you take this and you write down the equation of motion. You get an equation like that, you know, this that equation on top. You know? So that is like omega squared equal to k fourth, you know, the left hand side, with some additional powers of k squared, right? But there is a way of writing this theory by introducing another field, which is turns out to be the canonically conjugate version of this, which looks quite different. I mean, it still has the same pole, of course. I mean, it's the same answer, but this may be, again, a better way of thinking about, you know, such models. It's quite possible. The other comment I had about Lifshitz gravity, there have, of course, been lots of work on emergent gravity itself, right? You know, I think Peter mentioned something about that. I mean, in some trivial sense, you might have an emergent gravity here, but putting this model in a curve. Yeah, maybe in some target space metric curve, target space metric. But I'm not very sure, but this may be ways of obtaining emergent gravity as the test of infinite gauges. And that would be certainly interesting, you know, thing to play with. Yeah.
I have two comments. One is on the idea of possibly introducing an auxiliary field, which plays a role in the canonical conjugate to the metric. It actually was in my research paper. I think I called it at EIJ. Auxiliary field in writing, which is very useful if you have a field of detailed balance. And the auxiliary field is precisely the conjugate of the spatial metric. But it hasn't had any dynamic law, but it just integrated. It was just an auxiliary field level that I'll see in. And the comment on the emergent gravity, the model that we actually have at center issue, which I was mentioning, is there's really something similar for abelian gravitons.
Abelian gravitons.
What I mean by that is that you don't get a full interacting theory of gravity, but you can get a just like here, it's difficult to get an interacting the angles. It's easier to get electrodynamics. You don't need to.
Right, right.
So if you take your linearized diffeomorphisms and start with a bosonic system on the lattice, which has no gauge symmetry whatsoever, there is a set of degrees of freedom that you can look up, which gives you in the infrared an emergent abelian version of z equals 3 gravity, z equals 1.
I see.
Okay, let's have coffee.